Hello and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. If the book is anything to go by, I've a cracking episode for you. We're looking at the British decryption efforts centred around Bletchley Park. I'm sure to some extent you're all aware of the German cipher machine Enigma, which proved so challenging to crack. But how much do you know of the government code and cipher school, which was housed at Bletchley Park during World War II? Joining me is Dermot Turing. If the name sounds familiar, he is the nephew of the now well-known Alan Turing, whose name is synonymous with the cracking of the Enigma code. Dermot has served as a trustee of Bletchley Park and the Turing Trust. He is the author of a number of books looking at Alan Turing and code breaking, his latest being The Code Breakers of Bletchley Park. But before we get started, this podcast is made possible by the very kind donations of listeners like yourself. The dollar or two that patrons of the show contribute help me find the time to put the show together, purchasing research material and paying for hosting. All so I can produce an hour or two of World War II goodness each month. If you would like to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/WW2podcast or ww2podcast.com and click on donate. When you become a patron of the show, you will get access to more World War II talk from time to time. Often, bits of my conversations with guests that never make it into the show. They might be off topic, for instance. And when I have some gems, I do make these available to patrons. So that's patreon.com/WW2podcast or click on donate at WW2podcast.com. Dermot, thanks for joining me. I wonder if we should start with the First World War. Everything seems to come back to World War One. Is that where the nucleus of the British code breaking operation starts?
Well, I think there's probably been code-cracking agencies since time immemorial, to be honest. We know that Queen Elizabeth had a code-breaking unit, and I've recently been told that if you even go back to the time of the Roman Empire, there were probably some code-breakers in the Roman Empire, though I don't really know anything about that. But I think what was different when it comes to World War One is that the invention of the wireless, you know, radio communications, meant that it was now possible for, in particular, naval commands to communicate over vast distances in real time. That was a really powerful communications tool which hadn't existed before. And of course, very rapidly, armies started to adopt it as well. But World War One and navies communicating by radio, obviously you need to encrypt the messages, otherwise you might as well be broadcasting it to the entire world. And so instantly the importance of having code-breaking agencies sort of dawned on people very, very rapidly. So I think it's not really surprising that in World War One, the Admiralty's code-breaking unit was the sort of dominant code-breaking agency, and it's the one that, on the whole, people, if they've heard of code-breaking during World War One, that's the one they'll have heard of, the guys in Room 40 of the old Admiralty building. And they had some amazing successes, partly because they were not shy of accumulating for themselves anything that looked sexy, whether it had anything to do with the Admiralty or not. And so they started breaking diplomatic traffic, and they reckon that they were instrumental in bringing America into the war by breaking some German telegrams that showed the Americans just how devious the German Foreign Office was being, was trying to essentially line up with Mexico to extract a whole load of territory that America had conquered during the Mexican War in the previous century. So, you know, there was a whole load of stuff going on there. And oddly, the story of World War One code-breaking is almost as powerful and interesting as the story of World War Two code-breaking. But that's where it all began, frankly, because the guys who worked in Room 40 in World War One were young enough then to be only middle-aged folks when it came to the time of World War II. And so they provided the kernel that the World War II agency, the one we know as Bletchley Park, had built itself around.
So at the end of the First World War, I mean, so many things get ramped down militarily. My assumption is, with wireless radio communications only expanding, presumably the same would happen for intercepts and code breaking. So did that department hang on, and it does that expand in those interwar years, or does it contract like the rest of the military?
No, it's contracted like the rest of the military. So, of course, everybody says, well, who are these useless people, and we don't need this anymore, and so we're going to fire them all. What actually happened, though, was that, of course, diplomatic code breaking continued to be of interest. And if you think back to the interwar years, the biggest threat that Britain perceived at the time was the Bolsheviks. So keeping an eye on what the Bolshies were up to seemed very important. And there are sort of shades of current international relations concerns here. You know, Russian agencies in the UK masquerading as trade missions, and what are they actually really up to? And so actually being able to intercept and decrypt their secret communications was very important. So after a lot of wrangling, by 1919, they had decided that they were going to carry on having a code-breaking service, and they called it the Government Code and Cipher School. And that's quite timely, because GCHQ, which is the, although it's changed its name, it's the direct successor of the Government Code and Cipher School, had its centenary last year. So there was quite a lot of sort of stuff about that. And obviously GCHQ is much more open these days than, you're allowed to know it exists. Which you were allowed to know in 1919, but it did continue. But it was a pretty small outfit until just before World War II started.
So it's that late into the 30s that they realised that was coming, that they decided to expand. And do they purchase Bletchley Park? Is that to be the centre of the Government Code and Cipher School? And why do they choose that build? The Government's Code and Cipher School is a bit unfortunate insofar as most people would just refer it now as Bletchley Park. The two have become synonymous.
Yes. Well, of course, it was in London until the outbreak of war. It came administratively under our old favourites, MI6. And in 1938, I think it was, the head of MI6 decided that they needed to have a war station for MI6. And they were looking for somewhere that was, not really close to anywhere like sort of centres of industry or what have you. And Bletchley Park happened to be on the market at the time. So it was bought for MI6. And for the first year or so, the code breakers had to share the premises with the spies, which was sort of interesting. But I'm afraid that eventually the code breakers sort of grew and the spies got squeezed out, I think. But yes, so by 1938, they'd bought Bletchley Park, but it was actually quite a good location. To what extent this was by design or just good luck, I don't really know. But it got great railway links. So you've got a cross-country and a north-south railway link. And perhaps more importantly, it was near the main north-south teleprinter cable. And people don't think about communications, but it meant that they could tap into or have a branch line. I'm not a telecoms engineer, so I don't know, but it feels like in railway terms, a branch line off the main cable going to Bletchley Park. And that meant that, of course, they could securely communicate with the service departments and Number 10 and, other important folk without having to sort of rely on things like motorcycle dispatch riders and picking up the phone.
So once they've purchased Bletchley Park and they're expanding, presumably they start to go through their Rolodex of ex-employees who'd worked for them during the First World War, but they must have had to expand beyond that. So how do you find I guess you've got a number of problems in finding recruits. They have to be reliable, security-wise, background-wise, presumably. And they have to be good at...
code-breaking.
Yeah, well, I was trying to come up with some way of what makes you good at code. You have to have that X factor that makes you good at code-breaking.
Well, the fact is that they had no modern scientific management methods for working out who was good at code-breaking. So... there was a bit of a nudge, I think, from on high, which said, we think you might start thinking about hiring mathematicians because we've got new methods of encipherment, which involve machinery. And, you know, your old fashioned approach to code breaking might not be quite enough. So they've hired their first mathematician in 1938, a chap called Peter Twin. He was just the first of several, and we're all thinking about Alan Turing when we say mathematicians, and he was fairly close on the list after that. But the reason I think they came across Alan Turing is the way they cast the net was to do, well, what any self-respecting senior civil servant would have done in the late 1930s, which is to go to the two universities. Apparently there were only two. One at Oxford and one at Cambridge. So they went to both the universities they tried to do what they called hiring men of the professor type. And it really didn't matter what the specialisms of the professors were. So, you know, some of them were classicists, some of them were linguists, and linguists sort of kind of make some sense. A handful were scientists, some of them were historians, one of them was a historian of fine art, you know, so there's a whole range of different academic fields of interest, none of which you would obviously link to code breaking. Some of these people turned out to be unbelievably good. Some of them turned into great intelligence analysts, sort of slightly different skill. And some of them turned out to be completely useless. But, you know, I think what was quite interesting is that this bizarre, completely random approach to recruitment certainly seemed to work in terms of the core of, you know, quite senior folk who were there. And many of the famous names that we associate with Bletchley Park were actually brought in during that recruitment drive targeted at the two universities. They were a bit more enlightened later on and cast the net a bit wider. So some other universities, and there were women as well as men, and some of them weren't even of the professor type. So that was the starting thinking.
Yeah, there's this story of recruiting people and their ability to solve crosswords. Is that apocryphal, or did they really pick people up who were champion crossword completers?
Well, it's not apocryphal, but what's difficult to get a grip on is how many people were recruited that way. Certainly a few were, the famous Daily Telegraph crossword, which said if you can solve this in however many minutes it was, then, you know, there might be something interesting for you. And if actually you turned up, you had to be interviewed by some chap whose name I think was Nichols, and he would then interview you to see whether, you know, you like the cut of your jib. So it's certainly true that some people were hired that way. And I think this was when, probably after about 1941, when they were really very resource constrained, and in particular human resource constrained, they needed to find novel ways of trying to get people with the right kind of puzzle solving mindset. And crossword puzzles, obviously, a fairly invisible way of possibly attracting people with the right kind of skills.
Giving them an entrance exam without them actually understanding that they've just fulfilled an entrance exam. It's just popped into my head now. So I did wonder, if you looked at how they hired people, if there's a sort of a curve on if they start with historians and classicists, but by 1945, they've dropped right off to mathematicians and electronics specialists as a reflection of,
and people from industry,
manufacturing experience.
Yes, so absolutely. I mean, I think the men of the professor type thing is really a very 1938-39 way of looking at it. By the time Bletchley Park has expanded a lot, and probably aren't that many Oxbridge professors left who are twiddling their thumbs wondering what to do for the war effort. But also, I think the experience proved that you don't really need to think about the world in that pre-war way. You're absolutely astonished that some people who you would never have imagined had the right kind of, you know, probably didn't have the right kind of background, but they were actually doing a cracking good job. So it's definitely right that by mid-war you've got a whole range of different kinds of people joining, and yes, you're right, you've got people joining because they're being selected, because we're now looking for particular specialists. So for example, when Alan Turing's mentor, mathematics professor from Cambridge called Max Newman, joined, he was one of the men of the professor type, but for whatever reasons we don't know, he didn't join at the beginning of the war. But by 1942, somebody's had another approach to him, and he was brought in, but particularly because they were keen to get people with mathematical skills like him in. And he was instrumental in building the famous Colossus machine, the one that broke the Lorentz ciphers. And without him deciding that the really quite challenging sorting methodology that they needed to get on top of this cipher, that needed to be done not by human beings, but by a machine. And he reckoned that they could build some super fast, or what these days we would call computing machinery, to, you know, crank through the problem and sort out the sheep from the goats to help figure out what the settings on the wheels of this machine were. That was because they just, you know, they were thinking about recruitment in a much more open and sort of what do we call it these days, sort of objectives focused recruitment policy.
I think the idea of the professor type fits a certain literary trope that perhaps is passed down and reinforces that image, which is possibly not quite true as the war moves on.
I think that's right. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly right for the beginning, but it's less true as time goes on. Yeah,
and I think another part of that idea of the professorly type, which it's overlooked, which you did allude to, is that 75% of the staff are women, and they don't directly get a much attention other than, you know, the wrens looking after the machines. But what are the female staff doing? Are they recruiting them from Oxbridge?
Well, here's the thing. We, as you say, we're kind of a bit duped into thinking about gender at Bletchley Park by this phrase, men are the professor type. And it's not helped by the fact that in the National Archives, there is this list of men of the professor type, and they're all men with two exceptions. And then underneath that, and it says old members, and there's a list of old members, many of whom are women. And so you're thinking, aha, so that means that the code breakers, who are the men, and the other staff, who are the typists, and we've got a gender divide. And I don't want to say that that's completely false, but it's not a complete and accurate picture, because what we discover is that, first of all, there are a whole load of academic women who were hired from, yes, in the first place, from Oxford and Cambridge. So a lot of women from Girton and Newnham in Cambridge, and from Lady Margaret Hall in Oxford, and a smattering of other women from other places as well. These women were hired, and they were hired to do basically the same jobs as the men of the professor type. But we run into another classification problem here, which is that, of course, if you were a woman in the 1930s, early 40s, then there were job descriptions that were available for men, and there were job descriptions that were available for women. And of course, being a code breaker was not a woman's job, that was a man's job. So there were no code breaker grades available for women. So in the records, the women who are actually doing code-breaking jobs aren't described as code-breakers. They're described as clerical staff or translators. And the classic example of this is Joan Clarke, who people might remember was briefly engaged to Alan Turing. She was a mathematician from Cambridge. And when they wanted to promote her, of course, she couldn't have a code-breaker job because she was a woman. So they scratched their heads to try and find a way to promote her. And then they realized, well, actually what they could do is if they made her a translator, then she would be basically on the same footing as the male code-breakers. And so she was asked to apply for a post as a linguist. So there's her application form said post applied for linguist. And then the next question was language skills, and she put none. But, you know, so they found ways. This is quite good because they found ways around the problem. And but of course, to people looking at the paper records 75, 80 years on, we can be deceived by that, and we look at the thing and we say, oh, look, all the women were typists and clerical staff, and all the men had all the juicy jobs. It's not quite true. And I found literally dozens of bright, either graduate or undergraduate women who were doing really very significant and difficult code breaking and intelligence analysis jobs, which were the same jobs that were being done by the men. So we have to just be a little bit careful to say, oh, well, all the women were bomb operators and all the men sat around in tweed jackets smoking pipes and solving the code breaking puzzles. It wasn't quite like that.
I think you make a point in the book, you point out that it wasn't unusual for some of the women to be a higher social status and better qualified than some of their male counterparts. And it's fascinating because that's not part of the regular narrative of Bletchley Park. You know, they got overlooked.
I wouldn't want to ignore the role of the majority of the staff, and the majority of the staff being women, who we did have a huge need for people to do really quite routine and dull jobs like operating bomb machines, operating the Hollerith punch card facility, doing things like typing the intercepted messages into Typex machines, which were rigged to behave like Enigma machines and spew out the correct plain German text. These are desperately boring jobs. And what happened was that the UK government took teenage girls straight out of school and stuck them into one of the armed forces, typically the Wrens, though there were army girls at, and there were women's air force as well, staff there. But so there were literally thousands of these. I mean, I hope people don't think it's politically incorrect to describe them as girls, because they are girls. They're just they're teenagers, and they're just out of school. And there were thousands of them, and they made the machinery work. Are we going to call them code breakers? I think we can call them code breakers because I think, you know, they're involved in the code breaking process. And clearly, they're not doing the same job that the person who analyzes half a dozen decrypted messages and says, hang on, guys, I think they're about to invade France. You know, that's a different kind of skill. But is that a code breaker? Well, it's probably an intelligence analyst, but they're all at Bletchley Park.
Well, that sort of brings to mind the Gracie Fields song. I'm the girl that has the thing that does the thing of Timmy Bob, which I suspect some of those girls working on those bombs felt a bit like that.
Exactly. No, exactly.
So when's Bletchley Park is in full swing, is it a military operation or is it a civilian operation? Who, in which case, how do to use the sort of seemingly Second World War parlance of boffins, how do they get on with the military types? Because presumably they both had to coexist together.
Yes, that's a very perceptive question. The answer is that it had its moments of difficulty. The head of Bletchley Park at the beginning of the war was a civilian in uniform, a chap called Alistair Denniston. He was basically a German teacher who joined the Room 40 operation in World War One, and then by dint of a little bit of politicking, found himself the head of the GCCS after World War One and into World War Two. Now, during World War One, in order to give credibility to the civilians, they had given naval ranks to all of the boffins, including Denniston. So he was a commander in the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve. But ordinarily, people in the RMVR are people who are sort of like Sunday yachtsmen who were called up for military service when, you know, in times of hostility. That wasn't true in the case of Denniston. I have no idea what his sailing skills were like, but his was a rank of convenience, similar to Dilly Knox, who was also a lieutenant commander in the RMVR, and I don't think he'd ever been to on a ship. These folks were not temperamentally the right people to be dealing with the problems and needs of military command structures. And that meant that chains of command in the huts where the boffins would typically want to argue together about the best way to deal with a problem, that's a very different way of working from what you'd expect in a military setting. And so when you've got military intelligence people trying to co-work with these people who want to argue all the time, it really isn't going to be particularly successful. And there was lots of friction and tension during the first couple of years, to the point where an official investigation about the dysfunctionality of some of Bletchley Park had to be implemented. And there was too much of that going on, and junior people, including boffins, were complaining, including a famous letter written by Alan Turing, Gordon Welshman, and two of their colleagues to the Prime Minister, saying, "Dear Prime Minister, it's pretty bad around here, and we don't have enough resources. Is there something you can do about it?" And I think, well, why didn't they put that up through the official channels? Something is wrong with the way this place is being managed. So by 1942. Denniston was, he wasn't exactly sacked, but he was moved sideways to head up a diplomatic code-breaking mission that was sent back to London. So he was out of the way and put back firmly into Civvy Street. And a real naval officer, who was called Commander Travis, was put in charge. And although Travis had been associated with the Government Code and Cipher School since the very earliest days, he had got a real naval background. He'd actually been on a ship, and so he knew how the sort of, you know, the services mindset was, and he was a very effective administrator and managed to find ways where you could instill a sort of more vertical structure into the way the place was managed without losing the creative spirit of the boffin. So Travis deserves a lot. I mean, I don't think people felt that Travis was such a warm and friendly and understanding creature as Denniston, but that's probably warm and friendly and understanding is kind of not what you need when you've got 10,000 people on site and a war to fight.
Well, it's a remarkable breach of command, sort of hierarchical protocol, when some of your underlings just write to Churchill at the top.
I mean, it's quite astonishing that they didn't get fired, actually. It was probably the right. It was probably the right outcome, because the problem was a management one, and those in power recognised that was what the issue was and dealt with it, rather than saying, who are these insubordinate folks and they should be sent to the trenches.
Well, I wonder if we should turn to Enigma. I mean, it's obviously what Bletchley's well known for. Now, something I hadn't realised was that the British had been aware of Enigma since its invention, and I think it becomes commercially available in the 1920s, doesn't it? But the British had concluded that it could be easily decrypted and almost dismissed. Is that right? I've got that right?
Yes, no, that is right. There's a thing that I call the Walmart version. I mean, you couldn't exactly go down to Walmart and buy Enigma machines in Walmart, but the commercially available one, obviously, because it was commercially available, you could just go and buy one, and so pretty much everybody did. You know, the British bought one, and I think the Poles bought one, and probably the French bought one as well. And the British analyzed it and said, do you know what? We're not going to use this thing because we think it's not very secure. The Germans also bought one, and they said pretty much the same thing, except that they said, what we could do is get the factory that makes these things to add some additional security features. And in particular, what they did was they added this plug board to the front of it. And the plug board was the thing that nearly defeated the code breakers. So the version that the German armed forces were using from sort of the mid-1930s onwards was much more sophisticated and secure than the Walmart version that everybody had basically written off as being not secure. That didn't stop some people using the Walmart version. Of course, everybody then could break those messages and prove the point that actually it wasn't particularly secure.
Yes, it's the Poles that actually keep chipping away on this in these interwar years, working on Enigma. Did any of that information find its way over to Bletchley Park?
Yes, it did. So just before the outbreak of war, I mean, literally in the July of 1939, last week of July 1939, the Poles invited the British and the French to go to a conference in Warsaw, and they revealed the entirety of their knowledge about Enigma and Enigma code breaking. And this transformed the state of British knowledge from being one where they really didn't understand things about the German Enigma machine, like, for example, what the plug board was and how it was wired and stuff like that. I mean, really basic questions they didn't know the answers to. The Poles knew the answers to all these things, having been working on it for 10 years, and they shared all their knowledge. And it was really with that portfolio of know-how that the British Bletchley Park code breakers were able to effectively start World War II already having got a bye to the second round. You know, it's like one of those sort of knockout, you know, tournaments. So kind of they'd already got to round two without having to try. I mean, that was amazing, really. And I think that it was because of that handover of know-how that Bletchley Park made such a success on the Enigma story and was able to keep one step ahead of the Germans for the rest of the war. It was really quite astonishing. That's an entirely new story, different story in its own right, the whole Polish thing.
But I'm right in saying that we use Enigma as a bit of a catch-all phrase. There, it should be really possibly Enigmas, because I didn't realise the Italians are using them as well. Is the Italian the first major success the British have?
Well, yeah. So the Italians are using basically a variant on the Walmart version. So were the Spanish during the Spanish Civil War, and so were various other countries. So the Swiss, the Croats were also using that sort of very basic version. So, yes, so that's right. But there were also other types of Enigma machines. So the German military intelligence organization, the Abwehr, they were using another variant which didn't have a plug board, but they have four rotors, and the rotors had extra notches in, which made it both more difficult and in some circumstances easier to break. So and then the German Navy had a different variation as well. So, you know, we got lots of different species of Enigma machine, certainly.
I think that never comes really across. People obsess about this sort of just one, and actually there must have been a whole raft of different teams slightly comparing notes on something that's all in each instance is slightly unique, which is not, you know, not part of the regular story that we ever hear about. So is the key to breaking this the Alan Turing's takes the Polish design for the bomb, well, they call it the bomber, we come up with a bomb. Is that the key to first breaking all the Enigmas with speed?
I think so. The timeline is that the idea of a sort of souped up version of the Polish bomber machine was thought about as soon as that meeting in Warsaw had finished in July, and Travis is already talking to the British tabulating machine company about the design and build of this British machine by October 1939. There's documents in the National Archives that dated the first week of October 1939. You know, I mean, they're really talking about quite advanced technical aspects of the bomb machine. So, I mean, that's an incredibly rapid development timeline. The prototype machine got delivered to Bletchley Park in about March, April 1940. It didn't work particularly well. And then Gordon Welshman, who was another one of the Cambridge mathematicians, came along and said, I think I've got an idea. And his idea was transformative in the efficiency of the machine and its ability to quite rapidly identify the way the Germans had set their Enigma machines up every day. So a version with his add-on came in by the summer of 1940, and that meant that by the time the Battle of Britain was on, the British were able to read the Luftwaffe codes, and you know, the rest is history. But so you can tell how crucial that meeting in Warsaw was to be able to get the British machine development up and running, you know, by October of 1939. That's incredibly early.
If you think they're not, as if they're just, you know, nowadays we'd print a circuit board, it'd be much, you know, these things, they're bespoke machines. Electronics is all very much wiring and valves, and there's a lot of, you know, someone's got to sit and manufacture this thing. And I was just thinking that the God knows how many meters, miles perhaps, of electric cable have to be put in. They're extremely precision machinery that they've suddenly concocted.
Well, that's true, but the reason that they chose the British Tabulating Machine Company was that these people had a trusted record, and the design of the bomb was the rotors on it, which have got so there are drums on the front of the bomb machine that behave like Enigma rotors. Those bits had to be specifically manufactured, but the design was deliberately put together so that all the other parts in the machine were essentially available components sitting around in the factory anyway, you know, so you could just go to the storeroom and get them. So the electronics come in much later in the war, when by 1943 they're starting to try and find much faster techniques for dealing with the Lorentz machine, completely different kind of cipher machine, and so that's not British Tabulating Machine, that's the Post Office. But again, it's a similar model, because using electronics within the Post Office, they were using electronic components for switchboard use, and when I say switchboards, I'm talking about the sort of massive, you know, automated exchanges where you know, you can dial straight through to your destination without having to ask the operator to connect me to, you know, Whitehall 1212, please.
that would be Colossus with its 1600 valves.
That would be Colossus, yes, with its 1600 valves.
Which are all essentially, you know, small light bulbs. I mean, they must be roasting those rooms.
Yes, I think so. So the Colossus rebuild at the National Museum of Computing, you can see what a huge machine it is, and you can go around the back and you can see all those valves, and yeah, it's hot in there.
One thing I hadn't really appreciated is the reliance upon IBM, that's, you know, the IBM we still have today, punch cards. Why are punch cards so important? Because, to be honest, I thought they came in after the war. I thought there were 50s invention punch cards, only to discover they used them for carpet making in the Victorian times, I think, when I was looking it up.
Yeah, they're kind of... I'm slightly puzzled by this, because the punch card operation was absolutely vital at Bletchley Park, and yet nobody seems to be particularly interested in it. I think it's probably because sexy machines like the Bomb and Colossus, which were modern innovations, purpose-built for code-breaking, have sort of captured the imagination, whereas IBM machinery could have been used by any business and therefore sort of what's special about it. I think that's the reason. But apparently there were 7 tons, so that's one truckload of punch cards being delivered to Bletchley Park every week to help them with their processing. And there's a load of stuff that's being done there. So, I mean, a lot of code-breaking activities is sort of deeply tedious. And so, for example, you want to find out whether two messages which are in cipher have been enciphered at the same setting or using the same page from a code book. And so what you need to do is just compare those messages and look for frequency of repeated letters or coincidences between the two messages, you know, that kind of thing. This is the kind of thing that's absolutely designed for routine mechanical processing. So the punch card operation at Bletchley was very, very busy doing these kinds of things, setting up, basically inventing algorithms for doing this kind of sorting and comparison work. And literally hundreds of people working in that facility. Yeah, and I'm still a bit puzzled why people sort of don't know more about it and don't find it as exciting as the bomb and Colossus, really.
To be fair, that's probably all that was the best probably means of conveying it in. But as you say, it's not necessarily as exciting as, you know, 1600 valves.
I think that's right. I think that's right.
Now, Bletchley Park's obviously a British success, but the war is an Allied venture. Did the Americans entering the war from 1941 change things much for Bletchley Park?
Definitely. First of all, there were some turf wars as to whether the Americans or the British should have control over certain aspects of it. So the obvious division of labor was that the Americans should focus on Japanese codes because they were obviously more engaged in the Pacific. And therefore the British should focus on German codes. Fine, except that doesn't quite work because, hang on, say the Americans, we're being cut out of the loop when it comes to the German stuff and we're not convinced that you're doing everything, you know, and sharing as enthusiastically as you should. And the British had exactly the same sentiments about Japanese codes. And so eventually that kind of division didn't really work. So the British got back into the Japanese stuff and the Americans took over a fairly sizable chunk of the work on German stuff, including in particular German naval Enigma, where they went and built their own bomb machinery to, you know, help them with the Battle of the Atlantic, and some very sexy, exciting machinery that was very different from anything that the British had come up with. So the American effort on World War II code-breaking is, it's an entire story in its own right, but it's very powerful, and they had some amazing successes and quite everything to match what the British had been doing. There's no question about that they were every bit as good as the Brits.
Yeah, I don't know. FDR obviously refers to America as the arsenal of democracy. I didn't know if that included swinging their industrial production might over to producing things like bombs, which presumably they could, you know, in theory, turn out possibly more of them than we could to do some of the heavy lifting.
Yes, they did, but they didn't ship them over to Europe. I don't criticise that because really there's no reason why you need to ship the hardware over when you can ship over the results much more efficiently. So the hardware that was needed in Europe was pointy stuff.
Well, yeah, it just if they've got the hardware, it just sort of shifts sort of the epicenter of what's going on, doesn't it? That's all.
Yeah, it does, and certainly I wouldn't want to underestimate the contribution that the Americans made, particularly from 1943 onwards, on naval Enigma, but also, as I say, on the Japanese stuff. You know, I mean, they had some amazing successes.
Now, I wonder if by the end of the war, there's an over reliance on Bletchley, does it become a problem for the military if something's not confirmed or mentioned by Bletchley Park? Does it not exist as a thing?
There are some examples, and I think in particular it comes at times when there is radio silence from the other side. So you might be able to pick up from very small snippets and scraps of evidence that something might be afoot. But if there's operational radio silence, you're not going to get the confirmation that the generals are really looking for. And the biggest example of this, I think, is probably in the Battle of the Bulge, the Germans' Ardennes campaign at around Christmas 1944, where the Americans were caught on the back foot. To be fair to the Americans, I think that they had been imagining that if some major German operation was in the offing, that it was by then, I think, unimaginable that they wouldn't have received some signals intelligence, ultra intelligence about it. But the Germans were being careful and they were on radio silence. And so, yes, if you forensically pick over the intelligence that was available, you would now say, well, surely it was obvious and they ought to have cottoned on to what was going on. But it was Christmas time and it was the winter, and at Christmas time you're not in the mindset to imagine you're going to be attacked, and in the winter you think that the other guy would be a fool to mount an attack, and they kind of assumed that we were winning the war anyway, and so the resources available for an attack probably weren't there. And without some very obvious confirmation in the form of signals intelligence, the confirmation bias was fully at work. So I think you're right. I think there are examples where over dependency on Bletchley Park turned out to be unwise.
So at what point do they start? I mean, do they indeed start winding Bletchley down, or is it like the end of the First World War? They see no need and they rapidly scale it down.
They did rapidly scale it down, but I think that it had proved itself so convincingly that the establishment of what we now know as GCHQ followed fairly rapidly on from it. So most of the Codebreakers actually moved out of Bletchley Park and into one of the new stations they'd built in North London during the war, basically for one of the bomb operations. But they put the remaining Codebreakers, including some of their, in fact, a fairly significant number of their World War II recruits, new folks who had got the managerial or codebreaking skills or analytical skills that, had not really been there in the pre-war operation. These folks were kept on, but obviously the vast number that you need for a full-on war effort were not needed, and so most of the bomb operators were discharged back to civilian life, and most of the professors went back to their universities. The GCHQ, as we now know it, began pretty much in August of 1945, with the end of the war, and I don't know exactly when they renamed themselves GCHQ, but it was within a couple of years of the end of the war.
Yeah, I got the feeling it was almost they could wind right down, but almost as soon as the war ends, the Cold War starts, and then it all goes into the reverse, and they find a new equilibrium as it winds back up again.
Well, exactly. And you now look at the number of people that work for GCHQ in Cheltenham, and you'll realise that, actually the need for this stuff hasn't exactly gone away.
No, I suspect it's as big as it ever has been. If not, the operation must be enormous of the amount of traffic that they have to.
Well, if I knew how many people worked at GCHQ, I probably wouldn't be allowed to tell you.
So why did it take so long for the story of Bletchley Park and the code breakers to come out? Because presumably in the histories of the war, did no one ever notice that there's gaps on how we suddenly knew things, when all these histories are coming out in the 50s, 60s and 70s? But it's not until the mid-70s, really, that the work of the code breakers at Bletchley Park filters out.
Well, this is the biggest cover-up operation in history, isn't it? Because what happened during the war is, of course, we couldn't tell the Germans how we knew things, so we had to provide fake cover stories to explain away signals intelligence. So, for example, the Battle of Matapan, which the reading of Italian naval Enigma was highly instrumental in knowing where the Italian fleet was so that Admiral Cunningham could get his forces into the right place at the right time. It would have been a bit of a giveaway if Admiral Cunningham had just turned up out of the blue. So they sent over a spotter plane to spot the Italian fleet. "Oh, look," says the spotter plane, "I've spotted the Italian fleet." So the spotter plane pilot gets a medal for essentially being the cover story, though he didn't know it. And the Bletchley Park co-breakers are all saying, "Hang on, that medal belongs to us, really." So you've always got a cover story, and I think that was a convenient and helpful, plausible excuse for those who actually knew the truth and were writing snuff in the post-war period where they couldn't talk about Bletchley Park. You couldn't talk about Bletchley Park because GCHQ officially didn't exist right up until, you know, really late 70s, early 80s. GCHQ wasn't, you and I weren't allowed to know that it existed. I think the idea of preserving the secrecy of the existence of the place and the existence of techniques for breaking foreign codes was something that was regarded as probably the most important state secret. And so that's why we never got to find out about Bletchley Park. And yet stuff started to leak out, and in particular discoveries in other countries that, in Poland, for example, they discovered that the Enigma machine had been broken by the Polish code breakers. That news trickled out in 1967, but you know, who in Britain was going to read a book in Polish that probably wasn't available on this side of the Iron Curtain? So that probably wasn't a big story. But then the French started leaking stuff out, and as is often the way, what happens is somebody writes something that they've picked up a fag end from somewhere and they've got it slightly wrong. And so then what happened in France was that the principal French military intelligence guy who'd been involved in the Enigma story from the French side decided to write his memoirs and explain, without giving any names and without mentioning Bletchley Park, but to put the record straight. And of course, once that's out and that's in French, and then that's saying we broke the German Enigma machine, and I'm saying, "What's going on? That's very interesting. What's going on?" And then, of course, the Brits say, "Well, hang on. They're taking all the glory for what we actually did. And can't I write my memoirs now?" And very soon, the cat was completely out of the bag. So by the end of the 1970s, it was just completely impossible to, keep the lid on it.
Well, I wondered if you have academics writing around the halls because they were part of the operation, so they facilitated the cover-up.
Yes, so the official history of British intelligence in the Second World War was the government's response to all this sort of thirst for knowledge once the cat was out of the bag, and that meant that they could actually control to some degree. I mean, by giving the official historian, who's an old Bletchley Park hand, as well as an academic historian, you know, you got access to the files, mate, but what you do is, as with all official historians, you can only print the stuff that we're happy to go in to see in print. So there's an element of censorship going on there. And I think that meant that some distortions crept in. And while it's still, you know, I mean, it's effectively a rewriting of the story of World War II with loads of the stuff that was previously missing put back in. So it's really, really helpful. You know, these days one can criticize bits of it for not being, you know, completely frank, or indeed where some stuff is said, but there's no source given for it, so you don't know whether it's the historian's own personal opinion or whether it is something that comes out of an archival document that still hasn't been declassified.
But I was going to say, my final question was, do you think we have the full picture? Is everything now declassified, or is there still things to fall out?
No, I'm confident that stuff has not all been declassified. GCHQ said they were going to make a big effort in connection with their centenary to get everything relating to World War II and Bletchley Park declassified, but they can't do this unilaterally because, you know, some of it relates to, in particular, the relationship with the US, and so, you know, the US have to be comfortable with it too. And so I've discovered that in the US, I was in their National Archives only last month before travel was restricted. I asked to call up a file and I was told, no, I'm sorry, you can't have that, it's still classified. And this is about World War II bomb machinery, you know, it's still classified 75 years on.
So. It's amazing, isn't it? After all this time, these things are still redacted. Well, Dermot, that seems like a good place to end. Thank you for joining me. Folks, Dermot's book is The Codebreakers of Bletchley Park. It's a very good read and puts the spotlight on some things that don't usually come up. Don't forget to give the Facebook page a like. I do try and post things there you might find interesting in relation to the current topic. Well, that's all from me. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.